and I crawled off to fetch my blanket. Curled up by Jamie's feet, I drifted drowsily off to sleep, surrounded by the sacred fumes of smoke and liquor, and watched by the dull, sticky eyes of the bear. "Know just how you feel," I told it, and then was gone. Chapter 16. The First Law of Thermodynamics. I was awakened abruptly just after dawn by a tiny stinging sensation on top of my head. I blinked and put up a hand to investigate. The movement startled a large grey jay who had been pulling hairs out of my head, and he shot up into a nearby pine tree, screeching hysterically. "Serves you right, mate," I muttered, rubbing the top of my head, but couldn't help smiling. I'd been told often enough that my hair looked like a bird's nest first thing in the morning. Perhaps there was something to it, after all. The Indians were gone. Luckily, the bear's head had gone with them. I felt my own head with ginger fingers, but aside from the small sting of the jay's depredations, it seemed intact. Either it had been remarkably good whiskey, or my sense of intoxication had been due more to the effects of adrenaline and tobacco than to alcohol. My comb was in the small deerskin pouch where I kept personal necessities, and those few medicines I thought might be useful on the trail. I sat up carefully so as not to wake Jamie. He lay a short distance away on his back, hands crossed, peaceful as the carved effigy on a sarcophagus. A lot more colourful, though. He lay in the shade, a creeping patch of sunshine sneaking up on him, barely touching the ends of his hair. In the fresh, cool light, he looked like Adam, newly touched by his creator's hand. Rather a battered Adam, though. On closer inspection, this was a snap taken well after the fall. Not the fragile perfection of a child born of clay, nor yet the unused beauty of the youth God loved. No, this one was a man, full-formed and powerful, each line of face and body marked with strength and struggle, made to take hold of the world he would wake to and subdue it. I moved very quietly, reaching for my pouch. I didn't want to wake him. The opportunity to watch him sleep came rarely. He slept like a cat, ready to spring up at any intimation of threat, and he normally rose from his bed at first light, while I was still floating on the surface of my dreams. Either he had drunk more than I thought last night, or he was in the deep sleep of healing, letting his body mend itself as he lay still. The horn comb slid soothingly through my hair. For once, I wasn't in a hurry. There was no baby to feed, no child to rouse and dress for school, no work waiting, no patients to see, no paperwork to do. Nothing could be farther from the sterile confines of a hospital than this place, I thought. Early birds in search of worms were making a cheerful racket in the forest, and a cool, soft breeze blew through the clearing. I smelt a faint whiff of dried blood and the stale ashes from last night's fire. Perhaps it was the scent of blood that had made me remember the hospital. From the moment I first walked into one, I had known it to be my sphere, my natural place. And yet, I wasn't out of place, here in the wilderness. I thought that odd. The ends of my hair brushed my naked shoulder blades with a pleasant tickling feel, and the air was cool enough that the small breeze made my skin ripple with goose flesh, my nipples standing up in tiny puckers. So I hadn't imagined it, I thought, with an inward smile. I certainly hadn't taken my own clothes off before retiring. I pushed back the thick linen blanket and saw the flecks of dried blood, smears on my thighs and belly. I felt dampness ooze between my legs and drew a finger between them, milky, with a musky scent not my own. That was enough to bring back the shadow of the dream, or what I'd thought must be one. The great bulk of the bear looming over me, darker than the night, and the reeking of blood, a rush of terror that kept my dream-heavy limbs from moving. My lying limp, pretending death as he nudged and nuzzled, breath hot on my skin, fur soft on my breasts. Gentleness amazing for a beast. Then that one sharp moment of consciousness, of cold, then hot, as bare skin, not bare skin, touched my own. And then the dizzy slide back into drunken dreaming, the slow and forceful coupling, climax fading into sleep, with a soft Scottish growling in my ear. I looked down and saw the strawberry crescent of a bite mark on my shoulder. "No wonder you're still asleep," I said in accusation. The sun had touched the curve of his cheek, lighting the eyebrow on that side like a match touched to kindling. He didn't open his eyes, but a slow, sweet smile spread across his face in answer. The Indians had left us a portion of the bear meat, tidily wrapped in oiled skin, and hung from the branches of a nearby tree to discourage the attention of skunks and raccoons. After breakfast and a hasty bath in the creek, Jamie took his bearings by sun and mountain.
"That way," he said, nodding toward a distant blue peak. "See where it makes a notch wi' the shorter one. On the other side, it's the Indians' land. The new treaty line follows that ridge."
"Someone actually surveyed through there?"
I peered unbelievingly at the vista of saw-toothed mountain ranges rising from valleys filled with morning mist. The mountains rose ahead of us like an endless series of floating mirages, fading from black-green to blue to purple, the farthest peaks etched black and needle-sharp against a crystal sky.
"Oh, aye."
He swung up into his saddle, turning his horse's head so the sun fell over his shoulder.
"They had to say for sure which land could be taken for settling. I made sure of the boundary before we left Wilmington, and Meyer said the same, this side of the highest ridge. I did think to ask the fellows who dined with us last night, though only to be sure they thought so too."
He grinned down at me.
"Ready, Sassenach?"
"As I'll ever be,"
I assured him, and turned my horse to follow. He had rinsed out his shirt, or what was left of it, in the stream. The stained rag of linen was spread out to dry behind his saddle, leaving him half naked in leather riding breeks, his plaid wrapped carelessly round his waist. The long scratches left by the bear's attack were black across his fair skin, but there was no visible inflammation, and from the ease with which he moved in the saddle, the wounds seemed not to trouble him. Neither did anything else, so far as I could see. The tinge of wariness he always bore was still with him. It had been part of him since boyhood. But some weight had lifted in the night. I thought perhaps it was our meeting with the three hunters. This first encounter with savages had been vastly reassuring to us both, and seemed substantially to have eased Jamie's visions of tomahawk-wielding cannibals behind every tree. Or it might be the trees themselves. Or the mountains. His spirits had grown lighter with every foot upward from the coastal plain. I couldn't help sharing his apparent joy, but at the same time felt a growing dread of what that joy might lead to. By mid-morning, the slopes had grown too thickly forested to ride any farther. Looking up a nearly vertical rock face into a dizzying tangle of dark branches sparked with gold and green and brown, I was inclined to think the horses were lucky to be stopping at the bottom. We hobbled them near a stream, thick with grass along its edge, and plunged in on foot, onward and upward, ever deeper, into the bloody forest primeval. "Towering pines and hemlocks, was it?" I thought, clambering over the burled knots of a fallen tree. The monstrous trunks rose so high that the lowest limbs started 20 feet above my head. Longfellow had no idea. The air was damp, cool but fecund, and my moccasins sank soundlessly into centuries-thick black leaf mould. My own footprints in the soft mud of a stream bank seemed strange and sudden as a dinosaur's track. We reached the top of a ridge, only to find another before us, and another beyond. I didn't know what we might be looking for, or how we would know if we found it. Jamie covered miles with his tireless hill-walker's stride, taking in everything. I tagged behind, enjoying the scenery, pausing now and then to gather some fascinating plant or root, stowing my treasures in the bag at my belt. We made our way along the back of one ridge, only to find our way blocked by a great heathbald, a patch of mountain laurel that looked from a distance like a shiny bear patch among the dark conifers, but closer to proved to be an impenetrable thicket, its springy branches interwoven like a basket. We backtracked and turned downward, out from under the huge fragrant firs, across slopes of wild timothy and mully grass that had gone bright yellow in the sun, and at last back into the soothing green of oak and hickory on a wooded bluff that overlooked a small and nameless river. It was cool under the tree's sudden shade, and I sighed in relief, lifting the hair off my neck to admit a breath of air. Jamie heard me and turned, smiling, holding back a limber branch so that I could follow him. We didn't talk much. Aside from the breath required for climbing, the mountain itself seemed to inhibit speech. Full of secret green places, it was a vivid offspring of the ancient Scottish mountains, thick with forest, and twice the height of those barren black parental crags. Still, its air held the same injunction to silence, the same promise of enchantment. The ground here was covered in a foot-deep layer of fallen leaves, soft and spongy underfoot, and the spaces between the trees seemed illusionary, as though to pass between those huge lichen trunks might transport one suddenly to another dimension of reality. Jamie's hair sparked in the occasional shafts of sunlight, a torch to follow through the shadows of the wood. It had darkened somewhat over the years to a deep, rich auburn, but the long days of riding and walking in the sun had bleached his crown to copper fire. He had lost the thong that bound his hair. He paused and brushed the thick, damp locks back from his face, so that I saw the startling streak of white just above one temple. Normally hidden among the darker red, it showed rarely, a legacy of the bullet wound received in the cave of Abandawi. Despite the warmth of the day, I shivered slightly in recollection. I would greatly have preferred to forget Haiti and its savage mysteries altogether, but there was little hope of that. Sometimes, on the verge of sleep, I would hear the voice of the cave wind and the nagging echo of the thought that came in its wake. Where else? We climbed a granite ledge, thick with moss and lichen, wet with the omnipresent flow of water, then followed the path of a descending freshet, brushing aside long grass that pulled at our legs, dodging the drooping branches of mountain laurel and the thick-leaved rhododendrons. Wonders sprang up by my feet, small orchids and brilliant fungi, trembling and shiny as jellies, shimmering red and black on fallen tree trunks. Dragonflies hung over the water, jewels immobile in the air, vanishing in mist. I felt dazed with abundance, ravished by beauty. Jamie's face bore the dream-stunned look of a man who knows himself sleeping but doesn't wish to wake. Paradoxically, the better I felt, the worse I felt too. Desperately happy and desperately afraid. This was his place, and surely he felt it as well as I. In early afternoon, we stopped to rest and drink from a small spring at the edge of a natural clearing. The ground beneath the maple trees was covered with a thick carpet of dark green leaves, among which I caught a sudden telltale flash of red. "Wild strawberries," I said with delight. The berries were dark red and tiny, about the size of my thumb joint. By the standards of modern horticulture, they would have been too tart, nearly bitter. But eaten with a meal consisting of half-cooked cold bear meat and rock-hard corn dodgers, they were delicious. Fresh explosions of flavour in my mouth, pinpricks of sweetness on my tongue. I gathered handfuls in my cloak, not caring for stains. What was a little strawberry juice among the stains of pine pitch, soot, leaf smudges, and simple dirt? By the time I had finished, my fingers were sticky and pungent with juice. My stomach was comfortably full, and the inside of my mouth felt as though it had been sandpapered from the tartly acid taste of the berries. Still, I couldn't resist reaching for just one more. Jamie leaned his back against the sycamore, eyelids half-lowered against the dazzle of afternoon sun. The little clearing held light like a cup, still and limpid.
"What do you think of this place, Sassenach?" he asked.
"I think it's beautiful. Don't you?"
He nodded, looking down between the trees, where a gentle slope full of wild hay and timothy fell away and rose again in a line of willows that fringed the distant river.
"I am thinking," Jamie said, a little awkwardly. "There is the spring here in the wood, that meadow below."
He waved a hand toward the scrim of alders that screened the ridge from the grassy slope.
"It would do for a few beasts at first, and then the land nearer the river might be cleared and put in crops. The rise of the land here is good for drainage. And here, see?"
Caught by visions, he rose to his feet, pointing. I looked carefully. To me, the place seemed little different from any of the steep wooded slopes and grassy coves through which we had wandered for the last couple of days. But to Jamie, with his farmer's eye, houses and stock pens and fields sprang up like fairy mushrooms in the shadow of the trees. Happiness was sticking out all over him like porcupine quills. My heart felt like lead in my chest.
"You're thinking we might settle here, then? Take the governor's offer?"
He looked at me, stopping abruptly in his speculations.
"We might," he said, "if..."
He broke off and looked sideways at me. Sun-reddened as he was, I couldn't tell whether he was flushed with sun or shyness.
"Do you believe in signs at all, Sassenach?"
"What sorts of signs?" I asked guardedly. In answer, he bent, plucked a sprig from the ground, and dropped it into my hand. The dark green leaves like small round Chinese fans, a pure white flower on a slender stem, and on another a half-ripe berry, its shoulders pale with shade, blushing crimson at the tip.
"This, it's ours, do you see?" he said.
"Ours?"
"The Fraser's, I mean," he explained.
One large, blunt finger gently prodded the berry.
"Strawberries, he always been the emblem of the clan. It's what the name meant, to start with, when a Monsieur Fraiselier came across from France, wee King William that was, and took hold of land in the Scottish mountains for his trouble."
King William that was. William the Conqueror, that was. Perhaps not the oldest of the Highland clans, the Frasers still had a distinguished heritage.
Warriors from the start, were you? And farmers, too.
The doubt in his eyes was fading into a smile. I didn't say what I was thinking, but I knew well enough that the thought must lie in his mind as well. There was no more of Clan Fraser, save scattered fragments, those who had survived by flight, by stratagem or luck. The clans had been smashed at Culloden, their chieftains slaughtered in battle or murdered by law. Yet here he stood, tall and straight in his plaid, the dark steel of a Highland dirk by his side, warrior and farmer both. And if the soil beneath his feet was not that of Scotland, it was free air that he breathed, and a mountain wind that stirred his hair, lifting copper strands to the summer sun. I smiled up at him, fighting back my growing dismay.
"Fraiselier, eh? Mr. Strawberry?
He grew them, did he? Or was he only fond of eating them?"
"Either, or both," he said dryly. "Or it was maybe only that he was red-heated, aye?"
I laughed, and he hunkered down beside me, unpinning his plaid.
"It's a rare plant," he said, touching the sprig in my open hand. "Flowers, fruit and leaves all together at the one time. The white flowers are for honour, and red fruit for courage, and the green leaves are for constancy."
My throat felt tight as I looked at him. "They got that one right," I said. He caught my hand in his own, squeezing my fingers around the tiny stem.
"And the fruit is the shape of a heart," he said softly,
and bent to kiss me. The tears were near the surface. At least I had a good excuse for the one that oozed free. He dabbed it away, then stood up and pulled his belt loose, letting the plaid fall in folds around his feet. Then he stripped off shirt and breeks and smiled down at me, naked.
"There's no one here," he said. "No one but us."
I would have said this seemed no reason, but I felt what it was he meant. We had been for days surrounded by vastness and threat, the wilderness no farther away than the pale circle of our fire. Yet here we were alone together, part and parcel of the place, with no need in broad daylight to hold the wilderness at bay.
"In the old days, men would do this to give fertility to the fields," he said, giving me a hand to rise.
"I don't see any fields,"
and wasn't sure whether to hope I never would.
Nonetheless, I skimmed off my buckskin shirt and pulled loose the knot of my makeshift brassiere.
He eyed me with appreciation.
"Well, no doubt I shall have to cut down a few trees first, but that can wait, aye."
We made a bed of plaid and cloaks and lay down upon it, naked, skin to skin among the yellow grasses and the scent of balsam and wild strawberries. We touched each other for what might have been a very long time, or no time at all, together in the garden of earthly delight. I forced away the thoughts that had plagued me up the mountain, determined only to share his joy for as long as it lasted. I grasped him tight, and he breathed in deep and pressed himself hard into my hand.
"And what would Eden be without a serpent?" I murmured, fingers stroking.
His eyes creased into blue triangles, so close I could see the black of his pupils.
"And will ye eat with me then, Mukria, of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil?"
I put out the tip of my tongue and drew it along his lower lip in answer. He shivered under my fingers, though the air was warm and sweet.
"Je suis prêt," I said, "Monsieur Fraiselière."
His head bent and his mouth fastened on my nipple, swollen as one of the tiny ripe berries.
"Madame Fraiselière,"
he whispered back,
"je suis à votre service."
And then we shared the fruit and flowers, and the green leaves covering all. We lay tangled in drowsiness, stirring only to bat away inquisitive insects until the first shadows touched our feet. Jamie rose quietly and covered me with a cloak, thinking me asleep. I heard the stealthy rustle as he dressed himself, and then the soft swish of his passage through the grass. I rolled over and saw him a little distance away, standing at the edge of the wood, looking out over the fall of land toward the river. He wore nothing but his plaid, crumpled and blood-stained, belted round his waist. With his hair unbound and tangled round his shoulders, he looked the wild Highlander he was. What I had thought a trap for him, his family, his clan, was his strength. And what I had thought my strength, my solitude, my lack of ties, was my weakness. Having known closeness, both its good and its bad, he had the strength to leave it, to step away from all notions of safety and venture out alone. And I, so proud of self-sufficiency at one time, couldn't bear the thought of loneliness again. I had resolved to say nothing, to live in the moment, to accept whatever came. But the moment was here, and I couldn't accept it. I saw his head lift in decision, and at the same moment saw his name carved in cold stone. Terror and despair washed over me. As though he had heard the echo of my unspoken cry, he turned his head toward me. Whatever he saw in my face brought him swiftly to my side.
"What is it, Sassenach?"
There was no point in lying, not when he could see me.
"I'm afraid," I blurted out. He glanced quickly round for danger, one hand reaching for his knife, but I stopped him with a hand on his leg. "Not that. Jamie, hold me, please."
He gathered me close against him, wrapping the cloak around me. I was shivering, though the air was still warm.
"It's all right, Aneen Down," he murmured. "I'm here." "What's frightened you, then?"
"You," I said, and clung tight. His heart thumped just under my ear, strong and steady. "Here. It makes me afraid to think of you here, of us coming here."
"Afraid?" he asked. "Of what, Sassenach?"
His arms tightened around me.
"I did say when we were wed that I would always see you fed, no?"
He pulled me closer, tucking my head into the curve of his shoulder.
"I gave you 3 things that day," he said softly. "My name, my family, and the protection of my body. You'll have those things always, Sassenach, so long as we both shall live. No matter where we may be, I will not let you go hungry or cold. I'll let nothing harm you, ever."
"I'm not afraid of any of that," I blurted. "I'm afraid you'll die, and I can't stand it if you do, Jamie. I really can't." He jerked back a little, surprised, and looked down into my face.
"Well, I'll do my best to oblige you, Sassenach," he said. "But you can... I may not have all the say in the matter."
His face was serious, but one corner of his mouth curled up irrepressibly. The sight did me in utterly.
"Don't you laugh," I said furiously. "Don't you dare laugh." "Oh, I'm not," he assured me, trying to straighten his face.
"You are." I punched him in the chest. Now he was laughing. I punched him again, harder. And before I knew it, was hammering him in earnest, my fists making small, dull thumps against his plaid. He grabbed for my hand, but I ducked my head and bit him on the thumb. He let out a cry and jerked his hand away. He examined the tooth marks for a moment, then looked at me, one eyebrow raised. The humour lingered in his eyes, but at least he'd stopped laughing, the bastard.
"Sassenach, you've seen me damn near dead 12 times. I'm not turned a hair. Why ever are you taking on so now, and me not even ill?"
"Never turned a hair?"
I gawked at him in furious amazement.
"You think I wasn't upset?" He rubbed a knuckle across his upper lip, eyeing me in some amusement.
"Oh, well, I did think you cared, of course. But I never thought of it in just that way, I admit."
"Of course you didn't. And if you had, it wouldn't make any difference. You Scot!" It was the worst thing I could think of to call him. Finding no more words, I turned and stomped away. Unfortunately, stomping has relatively little effect when executed in bare feet on a grassy meadow. I stepped on something sharp, uttered a small cry, and limped a few more steps before having to stop. I had stepped on some sort of cockleburr. 6 vicious caltrops were stuck in my bare sole, blood drops welling from the tiny punctures. Precariously balanced on 1 foot, I tried to pick them out, cursing under my breath. I wobbled and nearly fell. A strong hand caught me under the elbow and steadied me. I set my teeth and finished jerking up the tiny burrs. I pulled my elbow out of his grasp and, turning on my heel, walked, with a good deal more care, back to where I had left my clothing. Dropping the cloak on the ground, I proceeded to dress with what dignity was possible. Jamie stood, arms folded, watching me without comment. "When God threw Adam out of paradise, at least Eve went with him," I said, talking to my fingers as I fastened the drawstring of my trousers.
"Aye, that's true," he agreed, after a cautious pause.
He gave me a sidelong glance to see whether I was about to hit him again.
"You haven't been eating any of the plants you picked this morning, have you, Sassenach?" "No, I did not think so," he added hastily, seeing my expression. "I only wondered. Meyer says some things here give you the nightmare, something fierce."
"I am not having nightmares," I said, with more force than strictly necessary had I been telling the truth. "I was having waking nightmares,
though ingestion of hallucinogenic plant substances had nothing to do with it. He sighed.
Do you mean to tell me straight out what you're talking about, Sassenach? Or do you mean me to suffer a bit first?
I glared at him, caught as usual between the urge to laugh and the urge to hit him with a blunt object. Then a wave of despair overcame both laughter and anger. My shoulders slumped in surrender.
I'm talking about you, I said.
Me? Why?
Because you're a bloody Highlander, and you're all about honour and courage and constancy, and I know you can't help it, and I wouldn't want you to. Only, damn it, it's going to take you to Scotland and get you killed, and there's nothing I can do about it.
He gave me a look of incredulity.
Scotland, he said,
as though I'd said something completely mad.
Scotland, where your bloody grave is.
He rubbed a hand slowly through his hair, looking down the bridge of his nose at me.
Oh, he said at last. I see then. You think if I go to Scotland, I must die there, since that's where I'll be buried. Is that it?
I nodded, too upset to speak.
Mm-hmm. And just why is it you think I'm going to Scotland?
He asked carefully. I glared at him in exasperation and waved an arm at the expanse of wilderness around us. Where the hell else are you going to get settlers for this land? Of course you're going to Scotland. He looked at me, exasperated in turn.
How in the name of God do you think I should do that, Sassenach? I might have, when I had the gems, but now... I've maybe £10 to my name, and that's borrowed. Shall I fly to Scotland like a bird, then, and lead folk back behind me walking on the water?
You'll think of something, I said miserably. You always do. He gave me a queer look, then looked away and paused for several moments before answering.
I hadn't realised you thought I was God Almighty, Sassenach, he said at last.
I don't, I said. Moses, maybe. The words were facetious, but neither one of us was joking. He walked away a bit, hands clasped behind his back. Watch out for the burrs, I called after him, seeing him heading for the location of my recent mishap. He altered his path in response, but said nothing. He walked to and fro across the clearing, head bent in thought. At last he came back, to stand in front of me.
I canna do it alone, he said quietly. You're right about that. But I dinna think I need to go to Scotland for my settlers.
What else?
My men, the men who were wi' me in Ardsmuir, he said. They're here already.
But you haven't any idea where they are, I protested. And besides, they were transported years ago. They'll be settled. They won't want to pull up stakes and come to the ends of the bloody earth with you. He smiled, a little wryly.
You did, Sassenach.
I took a deep breath. The nagging weight of fear that had burdened my heart for the last weeks had eased. With that concern lifted, though, there was room now in my mind to contemplate the staggering difficulty of the task he was setting himself. Track down men scattered over 3 colonies, persuade them to come with him, and simultaneously find sufficient capital to finance the clearing of land and planting of crops, to say nothing of the sheer enormity of labour involved in carving some small foothold out of this virgin wilderness.
I'll think of something, he said,
smiling slightly as he watched doubts and uncertainties flit across my face.
I always do, I...
All of my breath went out in a long sigh.
You do, I said.
Jamie, are you sure? Your Aunt Jocasta? He dismissed that possibility with a flick of his hand.
No, he said. Never.
I still hesitated, feeling guilty. You wouldn't... It's not just because of me, what I said about keeping slaves.
No, he said.
He paused, and I saw the 2 twisted fingers of his right hand twitch. He saw it, too, and stopped the movement abruptly.
I have lived as a slave, Claire,
he said quietly, head bent.
"And I couldna live, knowing there was a man on earth who felt toward me as I have felt toward those who thought they owned me."
I reached out and covered his crippled hand with my own. Tears ran down my cheeks, warm and soothing as summer rain.
"You won't leave me?" I asked at last. "You won't die?"
He shook his head and squeezed my hand tight.
"You are my courage, as I am your conscience," he whispered. "You are my heart, and I your compassion. We are neither of us whole alone. Do you not know that, Sassenach?"
"I do know that," I said, and my voice shook. "That's why I'm so afraid. I don't want to be half a person again. I can't bear it." He thumbed a lock of hair off my wet cheek and pulled me into his arms so close that I could feel the rise and fall of his chest as he breathed. He was so solid, so alive, ruddy hair curling gold against bare skin. And yet I had held him so before, and lost him. His hand touched my cheek, warm despite the dampness of my skin.
"But do you not see how very small a thing is the notion of death between us two, Claire?" he whispered.
My hands curled into fists against his chest. "No, I didn't think it a small thing at all."
"All the time after you left me, after Culloden, I was dead then, was I not?"
"I thought you were. That's why I..."
"Oh."
I took a deep, tremulous breath, and he nodded.
200 years from now, I shall most certainly be dead, Sassenach," he said.
He smiled crookedly.
"Be it Indians, wild beasts, a plague, the hangman's rope, or only the blessing of old age, I will be dead."
"Yes."
"And while you were there, in your own time, I was dead, no?"
I nodded, wordless.
Even now I could look back and see the abyss of despair into which that parting had dropped me, and from which I had climbed one painful inch at a time.
Now I stood with him again upon the summit of life, and couldn't contemplate descent. He reached down and plucked a stalk of grass, spreading the soft green beards between his fingers.
"Man is like the grass of the field," he quoted softly, brushing the slender stem over my knuckles where they rested against his chest. "Today it blooms. Tomorrow it withers and is cast into the oven."
He lifted the silky green tuft to his lips and kissed it, then touched it gently to my mouth.
"I was dead, my Sassenach, and yet all that time I loved you."
I closed my eyes, feeling the tickle of the grass on my lips, light as the touch of sun and air.
"I loved you too," I whispered. "I always will."
The grass fell away. Eyes closed, I felt him lean toward me, and his mouth on mine, warm as sun, light as air.
"So long as my body lives, and yours, we are one flesh," he whispered.
His fingers touched me, hair and chin and neck and breast, and I breathed his breath and felt him solid under my hand. Then I lay with my head on his shoulder, the strength of him supporting me, the words deep and soft in his chest.
"And when my body shall cease, my soul will still be yours. Claire, I swear by my hope of heaven, I will not be parted from you."
The wind stirred the leaves of the chestnut trees nearby, and the scents of late summer rose up rich around us. Pine and grass and strawberries, sun-warm stone and cool water, and the sharp, musky smell of his body next to mine.
"Nothing is lost, Sassenach, only changed."
"That's the first law of thermodynamics," I said, wiping my nose.
"No," he said, "that's faith."
Part 6. Je t'aime. Chapter 17. Home for the Holidays. Inverness, Scotland, December the 23rd, 1969. He checked the train schedule for the dozenth time, then prowled around the manse's living room, too restless to settle, an hour yet to wait. The room was half dismantled, with piles of cartons lying higgledy-piggledy on every surface. He'd promised to have the place cleared out by the new year, except for the pieces Fiona wanted to keep. He wandered down the hall and into the kitchen, stood staring into the ancient refrigerator for a moment, decided he wasn't hungry, and closed the door. He wished that Mrs. Graham and the Reverend could have met Brianna, and she then. He smiled at the empty kitchen table, remembering an adolescent conversation with the two elderly people when he, in the grip of a mad and unrequited lust for the tobacconist's daughter, had asked how to know if one was truly in love.
"If you have to ask yourself if you're in love, laddie, then you aren't," Mrs. Graham had assured him, tapping her spoon on the edge of her mixing bowl for emphasis. "And keep your paws off wee Mavis McDowell, or her da will murder you."
"When you're in love, Rog, you'll know it with no telling," the Reverend had chimed in, dipping a finger in the cake batter. He ducked in mock alarm as Mrs. Graham raised a threatening spoon and laughed.
"And do mind yourself with young Mavis, lad. I'm not old enough to be a grandfather."
Well, they'd been right. He knew, with no telling, had known since he'd met Brianna Randall. What he didn't know for sure was whether Brianna felt the same. He couldn't wait any longer. He slapped his pocket to be sure of his keys, ran down the stairs and out into the winter rain that had begun to pelt down just after breakfast. They did say a cold shower was the thing. Hadn't worked with Mavis, though.
December the 24th, 1969.
"Now, the plum pudding's in the warming oven and the hard sauce in the wee pan to the back," Fiona instructed him, pulling on her fuzzy woolen hat. It was red. Fiona was short, and in it she looked like a garden gnome. "Don't turn up the flame too high, mind, and dinna turn it out altogether either, or you'll never get it lit again. And here, have the directions for the birds for tomorrow all written out. They're stuffed in their pan, and I've left the veg already chopped to go along in the big yellow bowl in the fridge, and..."
She fumbled in the pocket of her jeans, and withdrew a handwritten slip of paper which she thrust into his hand. He patted her on the head.
"Don't worry, Fiona," he assured her. "We won't burn the place down, nor starve either."
She frowned dubiously, hesitating at the door. Her fiancé, sitting in his car outside, revved his engine in an impatient sort of way.
"I will. You sure the two of you won't come with us? Ernie's mam wouldn't mind it a bit, and I'm sure she'd not think it right just the two of you left here by yourselves to keep Christmas."
"Don't worry, Fiona," he said, edging her gently backward out the door. "We'll manage fine. You have a nice holiday with Ernie, and don't bother about us."
She sighed, giving in reluctantly. "Aye, I suppose you do."
A short, irritable beep from behind made her turn and glare at the car.
"Well, I'm coming then, aren't I?"
she demanded. Turning back, she beamed suddenly at Roger, threw her arms about him, and, standing on tiptoe, kissed him firmly on the lips. She drew back and winked conspiratorially, screwing up her small, round face.
"That'll sort our Ernie out," she whispered.
"Happy Christmas, Rog,"
she said loudly, and with a gay wave, hopped off the porch and strolled in leisurely fashion toward the car, hips swinging just a bit. Its engine roaring in protest, the car shot off with a squeal of tyres before the door had quite shut behind Fiona. Roger stood on the porch waving, pleased that Ernie wasn't an especially massive bloke. The door opened behind him, and Brianna poked her head out.
"What are you doing up here with no coat on?"
she inquired.
"It's freezing."
He hesitated, tempted to tell her. After all, it had evidently worked on Ernie.
But it was Christmas Eve, he reminded himself. In spite of the lowering sky and plummeting temperature, he felt warm and tingling all over.
He smiled at her.
"Just seeing Fiona off," he said, pulling back the door. "Shall we see if we can make lunch without blowing up the kitchen?"
They managed sandwiches without incident and returned after lunch to the study. The room was nearly empty now. Only a few shelves of books remained to be sorted and packed. On the one hand, Roger felt immense relief that the job was nearly done. On the other, it was sad to see the warm, cluttered study reduced to such a shell of its former self. The Reverend's big desk had been emptied and removed to the garage for storage. The floor-to-ceiling shelves denuded of their huge burden of books. The cork-lined walls stripped of its many layers of fluttering papers. This process reminded Roger uncomfortably of chicken plucking, the result being a stark and pathetic bareness that made him want to avert his eyes. There was one square of paper still pinned to the cork. He'd take that down last.
"What about these?"
Brianna waved a feather duster inquiringly at a small stack of books that sat on the table before her. An array of boxes gaped on the floor at her feet, half filled with books destined for various fates. Libraries, antiquarian societies, friends of the Reverend's, Roger's personal use.
"They're autographed, but not inscribed to anybody," she said, handing him the top one. "You've got the set he inscribed to your father, but do you want these too? They're first editions."
Roger turned the book over in his hands. It was one of Frank Randall's, a lovely book, beautifully typeset and bound to match the elegance of its scholarly content.
"You should have them, shouldn't you?" he said.
Without waiting for an answer, he set the book gently into a small box that rested on the seat of an armchair.
"Your dad's work, after all."
"I've got some," she protested. "Tons. Boxes and boxes."
"Not autographed, though."
"Well, no."
She picked up another of the books and flipped it open to the flyleaf where Tempora mutantur nos et mutamur in illis, F.W. Randall, was written in a strong, slanting hand. She rubbed a finger gently over the signature, and her wide mouth softened.
"The times are changing, and we with them.
You sure you don't want them, Roger?"
"Sure," he said, and smiled.
He waved a wry hand at their book-strewn surroundings.
"Don't worry, you won't leave me short."
She laughed and put the books in her own box, then went back to her work, dusting and wiping the stacked and sorted books before packing them. Most hadn't been cleaned in 40 years, and she was liberally smudged herself by this time, long fingers grimy and the cuffs of her white shirt nearly black with filth.
"Won't you miss this place?" she asked.
She wiped a strand of hair out of her eyes and gestured at the spacious room.
"You grew up here, didn't you?"
"Yes. And yes," he answered,
heaving another full carton onto the pile to be shipped to the university library.
"Not much choice, though."
"I guess you couldn't live here," she agreed regretfully, "since you have to be in Oxford most of the time. But you have to sell it."
"I can't sell it. It's not mine."
He stooped to get a grip on an extra-large carton and rose slowly to his feet, grunting with effort. He staggered across the room and dropped it onto the stack with a thud that raised small puffs of dust from the boxes beneath it.
"Phew!"
He blew out his breath, grinning at her.
"God help the antiquarians when they pick that one up."
"What do you mean, it's not yours?"
"What I said," he replied matter-of-factly. "It isn't mine. The house and land belong to the church. Dad lived here for near 50 years, but he didn't own it. It belongs to the parish council. The new minister doesn't want it. He's got money of his own, and a wife who likes Maud Cones. So the council's putting it to let. Fiona and her Ernie are taking it. Heaven help them."
"Just the two of them?"
"It's cheap." "For good reason," he added wryly. "She wants lots of kids, though. Be room for an army of them here, I can tell you."
Designed in Victorian times for ministers with numerous families, The manse had 12 rooms, not counting one unmodernized and highly inconvenient bath. The wedding's in February, so that's why I've got to finish the clearing up over Christmas, to give time for the cleaners and painters to come in. Shame to make you work on your holiday, though. Maybe we'll drive down to Fort William Monday.
Brianna picked up another book, but didn't put it in the box right away.
"So your home's gone for good," she said slowly. "It doesn't seem right, though I'm glad Fiona will have it."
Roger shrugged. "Not as though I meant to settle in Inverness," he said. "And it's not as though it were an ancestral seat or anything."
He waved at the cracked linoleum, the grubby enamel paint, and the ancient glass bowl light fixture overhead.
"Can't put it on the National Trust and charge people 2 quid each to tour the place."
She smiled at that and returned to her sorting. She seemed pensive, though, a small frown visible between her thick red brows. Finally, she put the last book in the box, stretched, and sighed.
"The Reverend had nearly as many books as my parents," she said. "Between Mama's medical books and Daddy's historical stuff, they left enough to supply a whole library. It'll probably take 6 months to sort it all out when I get ho- when I go back."
She bit her lip lightly and turned to pick up a roll of packing tape, picking at it with a fingernail.
"I told the real estate agent she could list the house for sale by summer." "That's what's been bothering you," he said slowly, realization dawning as he watched her face. "Thinking about taking apart the house you grew up in, having your home gone for good."
One shoulder lifted slightly, her eyes still fixed on the recalcitrant tape.
"If you can stand it, I guess I can. Besides," she went on, "it's not that bad. Mama took care of almost everything. She found a tenant and had the house leased for a year, so I could have time to decide what to do without worrying about it just sitting there vacant. But it's silly to keep it. It's way too big for me to live in alone."
"You might get married,"
he blurted it out without thinking.
"Guess I might," she said.
She glanced at him sidelong, and a corner of her mouth twitched in what might have been amusement.
"Someday. But what if my husband didn't want to live in Boston?"
It occurred to him quite suddenly that her concern over his losing the manse might, just possibly, have been that she envisioned herself living in it.
"Do you want kids?" he asked abruptly.
He hadn't thought to ask before, but hoped like hell she did. She looked momentarily startled, but then laughed. "Only children usually want big families, don't they?"
"Couldn't say," he said, "but I do."
He leaned across the boxes and kissed her suddenly.
"Me too," she said.
Her eyes went slanted when she smiled. She didn't look away, but a faint blush made her look like a spring-ripe apricot.
He wanted kids, all right. Just at the moment, he wanted to do what led to kids a lot more.
"But maybe we should finish clearing up first."
"What?"
The sense of her words penetrated only vaguely.
"Oh, yeah, right. Guess we should."
He bent his head and kissed her again, slowly this time. She had the most wonderful mouth, wide and full-lipped, almost too big for her face, but not quite. He had her round the waist, his other hand tangled in silky hair. The nape of her neck was smooth and warm under his hand. He gripped it, and she shivered slightly, mouth opening in a small sign of submission that made him want to lean her backward over his arm, carry her down to the hearth rug and... A brisk rapping made him jerk his head up, startled out of the embrace.
"Who's that?" Brianna exclaimed, hand to her heart.
The study was lined on one side by floor-to-ceiling windows. The Reverend had been a painter, and a square, whiskered face was pressed against one of these, nose nearly flattened with interest.
"That," said Roger through his teeth, "is the postman, Macbeth. What the hell is the old bugger doing out there?"
As though hearing this inquiry, Mr. Macbeth stepped back a pace,
drew a letter out of his bag and brandished it jovially at the occupants of the study.
"A letter," he mouthed elaborately, looking at Brianna.
He cut his eyes toward Roger and beetled his brows in a knowing leer. By the time Roger reached the front door, Mr. Macbeth was standing on the porch holding the letter.
"Why did you not put it in the letter slot, for God's sake?" Roger demanded. "Give it here, then."
Mr. Macbeth held the letter out of reach and assumed an air of injured dignity, somewhat impaired by his attempts to see Brianna over Roger's shoulder.
"Thought it might be important, didn't I? From the States, innit? And it's for the young lady, not you, lad."
Screwing up his face into a massive and indelicate wink, he oiled past Roger, arm extended toward Brianna.
"Ma'am," he said, simpering through his whiskers, "with the compliments of Her Majesty's meal."
"Thank you." Brianna was still rosily flushed, but she smoothed her hair and smiled at Macbeth with every evidence of self-possession. She took the letter and glanced at it, but made no move to open it. The envelope was handwritten, Roger saw, with red postal forwarding marks, but the distance was too far to make out the return address.
"Visiting, are you, ma'am?"
Macbeth asked heartily.
"Just the two of you here, all on your own, you?"
He was giving Brianna a rolling eye, looking her up and down with frank interest. "Oh, no," Brianna said, straight-faced. She folded the letter in half and stuffed it into the back pocket of her jeans.
"Uncle Angus is staying with us. He's asleep upstairs."
Roger bit the inside of his cheek. Uncle Angus was a moth-eaten, stuffed Scotty, a remnant of his own youth, unearthed during the cleaning of the house. Brianna, charmed with him, had dusted off his plaid bonnet and placed him on her own bed in the guest room. The postman's heavy brows rose.
"Oh," he said rather blankly. "Aye, I see. He'll be an American too, then, your Uncle Angus."
"No, he's from Aberdeen."
Other than a slight pinkening at the end of her nose, Brianna's face showed nothing but the most open guilelessness. Mr. Macbeth was enchanted.
"Oh, you've a wee bit of Scots in your family, then. Well, and I should have known it now, you with that hair. A bonny, bonny lass and no mistake."
He shook his head in admiration, lechery replaced by a pseudo-avuncular air that Roger found only slightly less objectionable.
"Yes, well,"
Roger cleared his throat meaningfully,
"I'm sure we don't want to keep you from your work, Macbeth." "Oh, it's no trouble, no trouble at all,"
the postman assured him, craning to catch a last glimpse of Brianna as he turned to go.
"Nay rest for the weary, is there, my dear?" "That's no rest for the wicked," Roger said,
with some emphasis, opening the door.
"Good day to you, Macbeth."
Macbeth glanced at him, the shadow of a leer back on his face.
"A good day to you, Mr. Wheatfield."
He leaned close, dug Roger in the ribs with an elbow, and whispered hoarsely,
"And a better night, if our uncle sleeps sound." "Here, going to read your letter."
He plucked it from the table where she had dropped it, and held it out to her. She flushed slightly and took it from him.
"It's not important. I'll look at it later."
"I'll go to the kitchen if it's private."
The flush deepened.
"It's not. It's nothing."
He raised one eyebrow. She shrugged impatiently and ripped open the flap, pulling out a single sheet of paper.
"See for yourself, then. I told you it's nothing important."
"Oh, isn't it?"
he thought, but didn't say anything aloud. He took the proffered sheet and glanced at it. It was, in fact, nothing much, a notification forwarded from the library at her university, to the effect that a specific reference she had requested was unfortunately not obtainable via interlibrary loan, but could be viewed in the private collection of the Stuart papers held in the Royal Annex of Edinburgh University. She was watching him when he looked up, arms folded, her eyes shiny and lips tight, daring him to say something.
"You should have told me you were looking for him,"
he said quietly.
I could have helped.
She shrugged slightly, and he saw her throat move as she swallowed. I know how to do historical research. I used to help my